Okay, mic check, mic check. Welcome to another episode of DisasterCast. Today, well, let me just talk through Project Rowdy for a little bit. Because I've had my head in the recent chapters, the ones I just finished, and a few of the early ones back to back. And there's a thing this story is doing that I actually want to name out loud instead of just feeling it in my hands while I write. So, here's the basic idea for anyone who, you know, really isn't that focused on the story. The Rowdy Rough Boys are not heroes. They were never meant to be heroes. They're weapons. Refined Hellspawn that he cooked out of raw chemical X to put the girls in the dirt. And then him fixed them a little bit. They got bounced out of their dimension on a dumb bank job and landed in the Invincible Universe. And Cecil scooped them up the same way you would scoop up a loose nuke and aim it at a kaiju. The whole engine of these kids, the reason the premise even gets anywhere, is the fact that they don't care. Brick thinks Superman is cool, Butch will go to bat for Batman as a vigilante, and Boomer thinks the Flash is sick. None of that is ideology. They like causing destruction because they're bored. Full stop, that's it. And a being that breaks things out of boredom is the easiest thing in the world to point at a problem. That's the load-bearing irony of this whole story. The kids are doing heroism for the worst possible reasons. Because they have things to break, and out of spite. But mostly spite. And it works. Everything in the prose has to keep two truths alive at once. These are children, and these are weapons. And the second you forget each one, the story kind of goes flat. So, let me get into how I basically balance both. So, the thing I'm most proud of, mechanically, about Project Rowdy is the fact that the narration changes species depending on whose head we're in. Three skulls, three vocabularies. And I can really prove that at the word level. So, this is this transcription thing I keep going back to. I call it consciousness transcription. And basically, tight third with zero narrator distance, and the grammar and noun choices belong to the characters, not me. So, Brick's chapter, one of his most recent ones, opens up on error, parameter mismatch. Now, that's not a vibe, per se. That's his actual interior register. His brain reaches for things like transdimensional wave mechanics, cross-spatial distortion models, externalized kinetic pulse, yada yada, whatever. When he hits the alien mid-fight and feels something give, the line that comes out is, "He's budgeting." That's a Brick verb. He loves the fight, but he's not always thinking of it as a fight. He's thinking of it as a system he can exploit. So the prose around him is more clipped. It's more declarative, diagnostic, if you will. Basically, when he's analyzing Damien's power, he's not like thinking of it in exactly the same tactile way Damien is. He's chewing on the idea, basically looping around the unsolved variable that is feel the grain. Now, Boomer is a completely different instrument, and I've only written one Boomer chapter, and that's also because I find Boomer chapters not hard, but hard to keep focused for a good reason, because Boomer's not focused. He's a completely different instrument, like I said before, and I want you to hear it. His pages and dialogues are full of elongated vowels. Really weird. Lame. Cringe with like 17 different eyes. Onomatopoeia doing real work. Like, his powers are his attention. He can't hold a construct. His clones pop after a 3 count. And he's all about speed. That's to tell. Boomer's interiority is scattered. He notices the wrong thing at the wrong time and blurts the secret he was whispering. The prose around him is meant to bounce, fragment, and crack an octave. Butch is the third dialect, and the easiest dialect. He's basically Bakugo. I'm not even lying to you. He's basically Bakugo mixed with Kid Vegeta. Pure aggression compressed into the shortest possible unit. That's why I feel like a Butch chapter, solely just him, would be really easy to write, but not fun, you know? But back to the point. So yeah, Butch's signature power, apart from his, you know, energy blast, is a green fist construct. Well, green physical construct that mirrors his own strike. And the description I gave for it is, what if punch, but more punch? That's the entire man right there, in just 6 words. I guess five if you count the fact that I said punch twice. He calls Brick's technique a Naruto ripoff, blows raspberries, and drains a cinder block-sized Capri Sun. His sentences are short because he is short. Short fuse, at least. Short fuse, short patience, short on the part of the brain that would hesitate. The lesson I want to bank from this for myself, for you, is that I am not writing distinct voices by giving them catchphrases. I'm letting the category of thing each character perceives change the available vocabulary. Brick perceives a budget, Boomer perceives something is gross, and Butch can perceive that something needs hitting. Same fight, three different ontologies. That's the move. I'm going to skip past because I wrote some notes about how I use semicolons, but semicolons are not fun. They're not interesting. Like, they're technical. But yeah, I'm going to skip right ahead. So the satire chapter, that's secretly a thesis chapter. So the hero hype hour bit with Force and Solar, the twins during the podcast, and I did design them after earlier Jake and Logan Paul, by the way. So the whole time they're whining about industry plants and manufactured BS and how the, and like basically how the boys are stealing their rep or whatever. On the surface, that's just funny world building. Heroism as a content economy. I base that off of how Eve mentioned Fight Force is the fourth favorite superhero team on Instagram. Or they're the fourth favorite superhero team in general, and Mark follows them on Instagram. But fun fact is that Fight Force did not exist in the Invincible comics. They were called Disaster Force, which is why in this setting I split them up into two teams run by twins, Fight Force and Disaster Force. But generally the whole point was that I wanted to tell you what I was doing structurally and the part that I want you to clock. Okay, so Brick's reaction is the whole point. Butch and Cecil both go, who cares, they're jokes. And Brick says, no, it's not about the public. It's about the others we have to expect to do their jobs. Brick doesn't care about reputation. He cares about operation. If the other heroes think the boys are credit stealers, they won't do their best. And that makes his job harder. That single bit right there does three things at once. It satirizes influencer culture. It characterizes Brick as the one kid in the room thinking like a logistics officer. And it quietly seeds the theme that these weapons here, these children, are more responsible than a lot of actual adult heroes would be. Which is honestly rather true for the Invincible / Image Comics universe. Those guys are some jokes. Like, they're really good at their jobs, but they're kind of jokes, a lot of them. Like, if you read Capes Inc., terrible. But yeah, that's a cruel little joke under the whole series. The comedy is the delivery system. The payload is the character and the theme. And this is kind of how you keep a downtime chapter from being filler. You have to make the joke and the thesis the same sentence. Now, the Dark Lord intro later on. Now, that one is a flashback from the actual scene. And I open it on Dark Lord, not the boys. The silence of the Dreadnought's command deck was not an absence of noise, but a weight upon his broad shoulders. Cold. Cavernous. And then, of course, I render telepathy as a wet pressure driven into the exposed brains of his crews. We do not negotiate, we call. Now, the craft thing I care about in this entire section here, because it's not a full chapter, it's just a section. I'm seeding the entire reveal about who Dark Lord is in plain sight and trusting that the reader won't get it. That's the fun part. Like, I'm putting the information there, but I don't expect the reader to understand why I'm putting it in there, because you're not supposed to understand it yet. The narration says his alien precision slid over the Chicago roots, that the voice forced out the ghost of a teenager that no longer existed, that Earth was the city he once knew as home. I am telling you, Dark Lord is a person from Earth, a teenager from Chicago, and because it's wrapped in cosmic warlord staging, it reads as flavor. Now, unless you're a big fan of Savage Dragon, you are not really going to know who Liberty Pharrell or Justice Pharrell or Super Patriot is. You should read the Super Patriot comics, by the way. They're really good comics. And then the chapter with Damien, like earlier, lands with his telekinesis, his feel the grain. And the two pieces are sitting in the reader's lap the whole time before they click in Briggs' chapter. Dark Lord is the alt-universe Damien. Damien from the comics. The half-Martian thing, the telekinesis, the same being who in this world is a nice 18-year-old who would probably be voiced by Kerry Payton, considering, you know, every black guy got to be voiced by Kerry Payton. Flexing. Kerry Payton voices a lot of black guys. I'm not going to lie. If you hear a black guy in a cartoon, it's probably Kerry Payton. And I love that for him. Is that how you say his name, Kerry? I hope it is. sorry. But yeah, the reveal isn't a twist I spring. It's a thing I planted and I let the reader assemble. That's the difference between seeding and dumping. The past doesn't get explained. It gets pressured out of the present. And then when the resonance cascade forces a question Brick can't answer, why would they match? I don't answer it. I'm not going to answer it. I'm not going to answer that. I put it there for you. I let it hang. And the withholding is the whole payoff. Like, I want you guys to get it. I want you guys to feel smart when you read it. I don't want to just write so you have fun. I want to write so that you're sucked in, so that you're thinking about it. And maybe that might be asking too much sometimes if you guys just want a chill day, or just like something cool to read. But like, I have faith in you. Oh my God. Donnie's chapter is also the cleanest example in the batch of feeding backstory through wound instead of exposition. I never sit you down and explain his relationship with his dad. I explain Donald's relationship with his wife earlier. I never really talk about his son. Instead, I kind of have Donnie's resentment do the backstory for you. The fact that his dad knew about his powers and said nothing is an example of that. So history arrives as a list of small grievances, because that's how a kid stores a parent's failure. It's not here is the backstory, it's here is what I can't stop being mad about. And the backstory leaks out of the sides of the anger. And then the turn kind of flips the whole thing. I want to be an agent, like you, Dad. The resentment was never rejection, it was a kid who wanted to be emotionally accepted by his father. Now that recontextualization is free for you. I built the grievance specific enough that reversing it lands. Lesson for anyone. Well, again, I'm not giving lessons here. I'm just talking out of my brain. Lesson for anyone. If you want backstory to carry weight, attach it to an emotional reflex, a current emotional reflex. Make the character react to the past in the present. Don't make them narrate it. Now let's get to the fun part, the fight. So, the Dark Lord Brawl is where the action craft has to earn the page count. And the thing I leaned on hardest, is geography is a measure for impact and scale. Okay? When Brick gets launched, I don't say, he flew far. Okay, that was not meant to be a Patrick, like, impersonation, but it kind of turned into that as soon as it left my mouth. Anyway, I don't say, he flew far. I count it in concrete. I have Brick skip across the interstate like a ruby red stone, a rusted Honda Civic scattering apart when he hits it. His forehead meets a concrete highway divider that becomes a fog of gray powder, and on the third mile, his boots finally catch. I have multiple named landmarks, multiple miles. The reader can measure the hit, not because I said, oh, he hits him exactly 18,000 feet away. No. I say, I gave them a ruler made of real objects. That's how you make force legible. That's how you make people feel a hit. Now, the shield mechanic for Dark Lord is the engine of the whole fight. Dark Lord's TK doesn't block. It bleeds. The bulk of the force did as it seemed to always do, bleeding off the hybrid and into the world around them. So every hit the boys land flatten cars and disintegrate billboards around the guy while he barely moves a quarter inch. Now, that's not just cool, it's a problem the protagonist has to solve, which is what keeps a power fantasy fight from being weightless. So, and I honestly, I was kind of inspired by a Satoru Gojo, of course, when I was writing that. But yeah, it's Brick. Brick is the diagnostic kid who reads the tell, who sees the portals flicker when ships cross them, which means Dark Lord's attention is not infinite, which means he's budgeting. The fight is a logic puzzle wearing a brawl's clothes, and that's because of who we're in. Butch's chapter would never notice that. Butch would just be like, why can't I punch him hard enough? Let's see. Oh yeah, two more things I want to flag. When brick moves faster than sound, speaks faster than sound, which is a weird thing I'm not going to get into. His dialogue collapsed into unspaced strings. That's a typographic cheat for super speed, like, I love seeing and I love using. It works because the reader has to slow down to read it, which is the opposite of what the character is doing and makes the speed feel more real. Also, the body keeps paying throughout the fight. The recurring nosebleed is the meter of psychic pressure. Ribs that groan, the breakfast he remembers inside out, and the resonant shockwaves that deletes all sound. Basically, the wind costs everybody something. Nobody walks it off clean. And on top of that, the kill, the Dark Lord kill, is the part that I had to not flinch at. Dark Lord is beaten, hands up, he's surrendering. And all three boys are just hit him one time at once. And then Brick just ends it with, well, that was gross. The flatness is the entire thesis paying off. The boys are not cruel and they're not righteous. They finished the job because the job was in front of them. The horror and the comedy are the same beat. Now, if I had added any moral weight here, if I had given it a moment, it would have made them heroes and would have broken the toy, okay? The point is, the boys don't have heroic weight. And my job is to leave the gap empty between what they do and what they are. I don't want to skip Debbie, but I'm kind of going to have to skip Debbie. I'll give Debbie a little bit, okay? So Debbie is kind of the quiet load the whole arc rests on. I'm trying to do a little bit of what the TV show did with Debbie without spending too much time on her the way the TV show did, because I feel like it did. Like, I love Debbie, but the show gives her a bit too much focus. Now, three 13-year-old living weapons are eating pizza and marathoning bad movies in Mark Grayson's mom's living room. Mark is in space. Her whole family doesn't exist anymore, pretty much. Her husband is gone. Her son is gone. And the prose lets Brick notice her without letting him touch it. He's noting that she's not sleeping. When Cecil's busted teleporter scares the daylights out of her, Brick at least wants to be tender about it. The boys want to be tender about it. Even Boomer calls out Cecil for that. So the same boy who notices a tired mom and chooses to leave it alone is the same boy who will insta-kill a begging alien an hour later. Holding those two facts in one kid is the whole character. He's a murderer who is willing to be mothered. Let's see. What else am I honest about in, like, Project Rowdy? Okay, I let the vocabulary belong to the skull, not to me. The fastest way to make a POV feel real is to ask, what kind of character and category can this person perceive? And then I keep that in the fence the whole time. Let's see. I also keep seeding reveals in flavor text and trusting the reader. I measure force in named objects so that impact is legible. And make the body pay so that violence has a price tag. Oh, also, I keep building downtime chapters on purpose that have characterization points, where the joke and thesis are the same sentence. So nothing is ever just filler. Also, something that I noticed when I was rereading my earlier chapters. Chapter 2 literally has a duplicated, shut your stupid face, copy-pasted back to back. And I notice I've changed in my writing because the early prose leaned way too much on adjective stacking and just naming the emotion. The recent chapters, they've definitely traded that for a different rhythm, which is tighter and trust the reader more, which I, after a year of writing, I'm glad that I have changed at least that much. The trajectory is good, and everything's there. It's just the first draft engine that lets me move this many chapters a month is the same engine that used to leave those seams, and I've noticed that I've grown from that, at least. But yeah, that's the thing. Rowdy runs on contradiction. It doesn't resolve on purpose. And the day it settles, the story's over, so I keep my thumb on it. Anyway, that's the machine. I'm going to get back to writing Nerd in the North now.